Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And today, our guest is someone I've known for a little while because she's made documentaries on things that I'm interested in. And just as a matter of coincidence, I'm in one of those documentaries. But I can be objective enough to say April Wright is a fine filmmaker. This is not like nepotism or favoritism. You're a very talented filmmaker, April.
Thank you. Coming from you, that means a lot. I've been a fan of yours for so long before there was such a thing as IMDb, when you could look up movies and get information. We had your book that got, you know, worn because we were always referring to it to look up movies or people or actors or directors. So yeah, I've been a huge fan of yours for a very long time.
I love people will show their books and they're always tattered and torn and used.
Right.
And sometimes they apologize and I say, no, I think it's much better that it shows that it's been loved. You know, you'd rather that than a pristine sitting on the counter and you never touch it.
Yep. So yes, it was, you know, something we referred to often, especially if there was a debate.
Yes.
Let's just check.
I apparently, not purposefully, settled many bar bets over the years.
Many.
Yep. I can believe that. Yep.
Now, your newest film, which we'll discuss in greater depth in just a little bit, but it's the hottest item here on the agenda, is called Stunt Women, The Untold Hollywood Story. And that subtitle is pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah.
It's a subject that no one else has really even approached, let alone tackled, you know, head on. And you do it, and you do it really well. It's about an hour and a half long, and
By the way, is always a great amount of time. For anyone listening, making any film ever, an hour and a half is ideal. 90 minutes makes us very happy.
Or less.
I feel the same.
But, you know, I thought like two-thirds of the way through, I happened to look at the time counter, and I said, geez, she's covered so much ground. What's left? Well, there's no filler. There's no padding. You're telling an interesting story every step of the way with all the people you would want to see talking about this subject. I'm exhausting my vocabulary here.
The closest, I think the only thing that's ever touched on it really is some of the grindhouse stuff where you see a bit of you know, that and what it was like to basically tape a woman onto the hood of a car. It's such a fascinating world, and the people in it, it's another one of those things where, like, I've just forgotten his name, the fellow who fake punched you.
Oh, Vic Armstrong.
Vic Armstrong.
Yeah.
You know, when people do get into this topic, it is fascinating.
Yes. There's an Armstrong in April's film.
Of course.
Andy Armstrong is in our film, who is Vic's brother, who also is a stuntman and stunt coordinator. Yeah, and he's great in it because he's pointing out how good women are at this job if you give them a chance.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we might as well tackle this now ourselves. The first issue is women. Women were pretty much excluded from this area of activity in the movie world, except in the silent era when a lot of the serial stars did their own stunts.
That's right. And I thought it was important to include that as a building block in the beginning of the movie, because a lot of times there are questions now. Can we, you know, do we have to swap out a woman for a guy to do this particular stunt or aspect of a stunt because it's too dangerous? And so by showing some of those clips from those early serials, The Hazards of Hell and The Perils of Pauline, there were a bunch of them at the time with women jumping from motorcycles onto moving trains or jumping off of bridges onto trains, doing a lot of horse work, driving work, you know, serials, like you said, they had sequels. And so, and the heroic action stars were women often. And then, you know, similar to what we touched on in our other film, once the studio system came in and the money people came in, a lot of the women got pushed out from writing and directing and producing, and also from doing stunts. So it's sort of the story of what happened in Hollywood.
It was actually routine in the action films and big stunts in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even 60s, mm-hmm. for guys to put on a dress and a wig, and they found somebody who had a similar build, like you wouldn't put a 6-footer into to double a 5-foot-1 petite ingenue. But you know, but it was almost always guys. And then slowly, people like Polly Burson, who you mentioned generously in your film, and Babe DeVriest and some of the other early pioneers. And then you have one of the all-time greats who I don't want to give away where you go with her in the film, but Jeanne Epper. And the Epper family looms large over the subject of stunt work.
Yeah, I felt like you couldn't make this film without including Jeanne. And the fact that she and a few of these early pioneers that were pushing forward back in the 60s. Jeanne Epper, of course, comes from a huge stunt family. Her father did stunts, her brothers and sisters, her kids. And also we have J.D. David, who doubled Pam Grier. And the fact that the three of them are still around, that's how I wanted to bring it to life with, you know, having them tell the stories directly from the horse's mouth.
There was a book, Stunt Women, The Untold Hollywood Story, written by a woman named Molly Gregory. And she did a tremendous amount of research, which was the jumping off point for the movie. So that was a tremendous help to me. But then I also had to bring it into the present day. Mm-hmm. And the book went up to around 2007. So a lot has happened in female-driven action since then. I had to figure out who some of the top stunt women are right now and get them involved in the film. But it was a huge deal to bring the book to life by meeting some of the women that were doing it in the 60s and the 70s and, you know, hear their stories firsthand. And the idea of putting them with the younger stunt women, so it's not just us learning what they did, but, you know, teaching a woman who's pursuing the profession, and for them to have the opportunity to meet some of these legendary women was really cool.
Well, that was a great, one of many good ideas you had in making this film. And yes, just a decade ago, we didn't think that Charlize Theron would star in a badass action movie or two or three, or that any number of other, you know, leading ladies would take this on. You know, I guess Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, was one of the first.
Yeah.
You know,
and Angelina Jolie has always been really big about doing her own stunts. There are certain actors, you know, a la Tom Cruise, the whole thing is, you know, he talks extensively about the fact that he does most of his stunts. The only ones he doesn't do are the ones that the studios don't think they can afford the insurance.
Yeah.
But, you know, it
does do them. That's true. All the stunt people verified, Tom does do his own stunts as much as he can.
He really does. As I say, the only time they don't is truly, I've read it before, when it's just going to cost too much money. It's too dangerous for them to waste that much money. But it is a fascinating world, and it is a world, you know, like with anything there, a good friend of mine, Jessica, she is a stunt woman, and she often posts photos with the actor that she's portraying, you know, when they have them doubled up. And we, as social media has become the giant that it is, we see so much more behind the scenes stuff than we ever have before. And that also adds to it, is that you're getting to know a stunt woman, which would be the case.
Yeah. People say that, you know, obviously the studios, especially in the studio system, when they had certain actors under their brand, they tried to perpetuate that idea that the actors were doing all the stunts. And, and people say that Steve McQueen was the first one to break rank and reveal that he had a stuntman doing most of his stunts and most of his driving. And then James Garner followed him to admit it. So there was sort of a breaking of the ranks and awareness. And then, of course, they made the movie Hooper and Hal Needham started directing. So there was sort of an era when people were aware of stunt performers. And then they've kind of gone into the background again. And you're right, the women's side of it has been shown even less. So it was cool to make this film.
And you also deal with the racial aspect of this. That in addition to women fighting for their niche, their place in the pecking order here, so too Black women who wanted to become stunt women had to fight, you know, not just prejudice, but not just racial prejudice, but, you know, sexist prejudice. And
all the prejudices in one,
and old habits.
Yes. Know. Yeah, and I don't think any, you know, even today, these things happen sometimes. They happen in general in the entertainment business, and I don't believe people intentionally want to keep women down or people of color down. It really is just systems that have accrued over time, and it becomes, you know, this is the way we've always done it, and people make the safe choices. And what really needs to change is giving women and people of color more opportunities early so that they get more experience and they build their resumes in whatever aspect of the industry they're in, so that when those bigger opportunities come up to direct a bigger film or to do a bigger stunt, they have the, you know, the resume to do it, and you're not like, oh, we've got to have this guy do it because he's got all the credits. Right. So it does start a little bit earlier, and I know there's a tremendous amount of awareness now that people are thinking of these things and how to you know, make it more equitable as it should be.
Mm-hmm. And you couldn't have picked a better on camera and off camera host. She narrates film as well as appearing in it, than Michelle Rodriguez. I mean, that's it. That's just another perfect match, because I first saw her, as a lot of people did, in the movie called Girl Fight.
Yeah.
And most people, I guess, know her. I mean, that was an indie film that didn't get, you know, the kind of wide release that the Fast and the Furious movies
had. But it had a following. Mm-hmm. It definitely, as you say, it was one hell of an introduction to this person.
Yeah.
And she's really maintained that kind of I don't know how to describe it. That has sort of been something that has stuck with her in every performance, that she's tough. Part of it is her build. You know, she looks muscular.
Yeah.
You know, she does, athletic. And then in most of the roles she's played, she tends to play more of a tough cookie. And so I don't think it surprised people to mm-hmm. learn that she was doing certain things, because she looks like an athlete. She looks like someone who would do this.
Yeah.
I want to go back real quick, because each one of the films that you have made, each one of these documentaries, and while our audience can't see you, as we're looking at you, behind you, you've got posters of your three films. You've chosen something, as my dad said, in each case, that's near and dear to us. You know, how do you... Is this just something that you loved? When it comes to something like stunt women, did it fascinate you? Did you read the book? You know, we're looking at movie palaces and drive-ins, which, of course, it is so funny. Before we started recording, we're talking about the fact that you made this movie 7 years ago, and now, because all of a sudden drive-ins are a thing, it's coming. But which is great. There's never a bad time to introduce people to a good documentary. But, you know, it is incredible how there's no way to know. But what brought you to each one of these?
Well, I had kind of a movie family growing up. My parents were into films and would talk to us about what made them good. And my dad had an 8mm camera, and so we had some reel-to-reel editing equipment and a projector. So I had awareness of film and the process of making films a little bit, even as, you know, a young child. And then we had a neighborhood movie palace right down the street from our house. And as we got older, my brother and sister both worked there. So I can remember going to that theater and watching Raiders of the Lost Ark at least 40 times in the theater. And so, and we went to drive-ins.
Did you get in for free?
Of course. That's why I could do it. Yeah, because my brother and sister worked there. In fact, Raiders we saw the night before because they would have to check the print back in those days. So you know, sometimes get to see things, you know, a day before everybody else, which was even more cool.
In those pre-digital days.
Right.
Yeah.
Get ready to prepare a physical print.
So, yeah, and we went to drive-ins. There was three open drive-in theaters in the area that I grew up. So, yeah, I was always interested in movies, and then I like cool things. So drive-ins are something I like, movie palaces. And when Stunt Women came up, it married my love of films, but also just the women's point of view and some of the struggle that they've had over the years in this business was very close to home for me as a woman director. So it was just the perfect topic. But the cool thing with Stunt Women was that I got to shoot action. I was saying the whole time we were making it, I'm mashing up genres. It's an action documentary, which you don't usually see very often. And the fact that I did get to take Michelle Rodriguez and put her in a drift car with the woman that does her driving in Fast and the Furious and shoot actual drift car sequences with a bunch of cameras on it and working with some of the top stunt people in the business to shoot that. It was, you know, I learned a lot and it was really fun.
So hang on, next time we hear screeching down the street, we'll know it's just you.
Right, or some stunt people just,
April, you know. April's coming down the road, guys.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up outside of Chicago. So I was born in actually in Kenosha, which is in the press all the time lately. And the actor Mark Ruffalo was also born there. He and I talked one time. We were born in the same hospital, which is no longer there. So some good people come out of Kenosha. And that's where I grew up.
What was the name of the theater?
Our neighborhood theater was called the Dunes. And I remember it so specifically because when I was really little, it had a box office outside of the building and a huge marquee with the D-U-N-E-S that flashed and had all the chasers and all that. And at some point, they took all of that down and put the box office inside a wall inside the theater and put the movies on just a really flat, boring, whatever they call it, on the side of the building. And they sort of, you know, reduced all the coolness. And then at one point, they did what a lot of theaters did. They split the auditorium into three screens. And so I firsthand experienced a lot of things that we talk about in the other movie.
Do you hear a high-pitched whistle?
I do. I what? Don't know.
Oh. I do not hear it on my end.
Good.
Yeah. Well, we'll just go on faith.
Yeah.
Can you make a note of where
we're saying? I'm doing it
okay,
right now.
Okay, very good. We'll pick up again right now. One of the things I like about the contemporary stunt women that you talk to is that they talk about how cool it is.
Yeah.
They're not jaded. They're not blasé. It's not just another day on the job. They love being part of this for all the right reasons and for all the reasons they were attracted to it.
Yeah, I feel like when you're I make narrative and documentary films, and when you make a documentary, two things. One, you do have to have passion for the topic because you spend a lot of time with it and usually a lot longer time than you do with a narrative film. So you do have to find topics that you love. But the other thing is, I'm making a film, but it's their lives, it's their livelihood. And so for me to get involved with that community and spend time have us, you know, build a relationship and a trust, because I need to tell their story the way they want it told. Right. I can't just be out here saying, this is how I think you are. I need to get inside. And if you do that and you pay attention and you listen, they will tell you how to tell the story the right way. And once the film was done and I showed it to stunt women, they told me that. They said, you know, other people have wanted to make a film like this or talked about it, but you nailed it. You got it right. This is who we really are. This is how we really feel. Mm-hmm. And so that energy that you feel in the film, the positive energy, how much they love it, but how they're also extremely smart about the risk taking and what they do. They're professional athletes.
Yes.
And I think all of these things come through in the energy of the film. It's they just do. Who they are.
They do. But you didn't study film in college, did you?
I studied business.
That's what I thought I read.
Yeah, I have an MBA master's degree from the Kellogg School at Northwestern. But as I was explaining, I had a film education on my own my whole life. I mean, when I was growing up, you would open up the newspaper to see what films were showing. And there were many times when we would open the newspaper and be like, okay, what movie do you want to go see? Well, we've already seen everything. What do you want to see a second time? Because I would see every film from the biggest to the smallest film. Right. And then when I switched into this business, which was about the time I met Jesse working at the Independent Spirit Awards, I got involved with the Spirit Awards. I got involved with Sundance and started helping to do programming at Sundance. And I also picked up classes at UCLA, writing classes and cinematography classes. So I had a good base of filmmaking just from watching it and studying it as my, you know, side hobby or whatever. But when I really intentionally said I want to get into this business a little over 10 years ago, I've been learning ever since. So, and I always say Sundance is a film school for me, because I'm watching hundreds of films every year and analyzing what they're doing. So I continue to be educated every day.
Well, I think that, and it's an obvious statement, but it's true. A good filmmaker is someone who loves film. You know, this has to be something you're passionate about. This has to be something you love doing. We're always amazed. There's a handful of people like Edgar Wright, where whenever we see them at film festivals, they'll have watched 40 movies. You know, they're the ones that go deep. And it's, you know, as much as to me, I'm just going, I've seen seven and I can't remember which one's which. But, you know, they're so excited and they want to take it all in. And that to me is the greatest thing you can learn about somebody. You know, it's the best thing, because the fact that you want to see all of this and support all of this, and especially when you're a documentarian, features of course, but when you're a documentarian and what you're doing is telling other people's stories, the more information you have, the smarter you become.
That's right. That's right. I've learned so much making every single one of the movies, learned so much more about topics that I already loved.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then you pass that along to us.
It's true. Well, I mean, yeah. Movie palaces, if you want to talk about something that is near and dear.
I want to do the in order. I want
okay.
To talk
okay.
About, the full title is Growing Attractions, the definitive story of the American drive-in movie.
Mm-hmm.
And
how do you get that on a mug?
I know, right?
It's too hard.
Now, let's start with a fundamental question. How many miles did you log making that movie?
Well, I will tell you, for the first one, the drive-in one, I traveled to every single state, including I went to Hawaii for a film festival and looked at drive-in movie theaters there. I haven't made it to Alaska yet. They had drive-ins there. I just haven't been there yet. But that's where it started. Are we breaking up again?
Oh, sorry. No, I said it's run by bears and moose.
Yes.
Alaska drive-in.
So for that film, I traveled the country. I didn't go to airport cities. I went little town to little town to little town. And so I was very thorough. When it came to the next film about movie palaces, I didn't have the budget to do all that traveling, but also I felt like I wanted to follow the film business. So I focused on New York and Chicago when it moved to Chicago and when it moved to LA. And then by showing that, it was showing the rest of the country. And I also had access to the archives at the Theater Historical Society. And so through that, I was also able to show a lot of country, a lot of theaters from different cities through the older photographs. Bless you. So, and then I ended up in Australia. I was there with the drive-in movie playing at a drive-in in Australia. And then I got into a couple theaters in Sydney that I also included some images of those in the film because they were, I went into the Capitol in Sydney, which happened to be an atmospheric, also designed by John Eberson. So I did include a couple of those shots, but I didn't travel as much as I did for the first film, but there's a whole scroll at the end of all the theaters that there's, video of, and it's probably at least 40 or 50 theaters. Yeah.
We got to go to an atmospheric in New Zealand, in Auckland.
Yes, that's another one that's in Eberson. So what they told me when I was in Australia, they said for years they had, this national pride or whatever. And they had always been told and thought those theaters were designed by Australian and New Zealand architects. But actually they had Australian and New Zealand architectural firms that had the names on it, but the person they hired to design those two atmospherics was John Eberson. So they look exactly like John Eberson theaters because they are.
Now, with the going attractions, the drive-in, the American drive-in, you actually not only went on the road to make it, you went on the road to show it.
Mm-hmm.
You were an old-fashioned roadshow, a one-woman roadshow for a long, long time. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was great. It was great to show the film at drive-ins because I got to visit some I hadn't been to yet, but also I got to become a double feature with some of my favorite movies. I was a double feature with Smokey and the Bandit, which was really fun. I was a double feature with Jaws. Who would have ever thought I could be on the same bill with Steven Spielberg? So that was really, really pretty fun and exciting to do that traveling. But I also, last year, up till March, I was traveling with our movie, with the Movie Palaces, Going Attractions, The Definitive Story of the Movie Palace, and I was getting to play it in a lot of amazing movie palaces around the country. I had just been showing at a bunch in Chicago, at the York, and I'm blanking out on some of the names, I'd just been playing at a bunch of those when COVID hit, and I got shut down and had to come home and stop the tour. So I was getting to see a lot of cool movie palaces with that movie as well.
Well, I got to see it at the Sedona. Alice and I were in the Sedona Film Festival last year, and
I think it was wasn't it in February or March? It was one of the things just before.
It was February.
Yeah,
it was this year.
Gosh.
It was this year, February.
Which seems like 3 or 4 years ago.
Because the Oscars were so early, you guys were actually, normally we don't get to go because it goes into Oscar time. Mm-hmm. And so my dad can't be away in those 2 weeks leading in. This year, because they moved the Oscars to the beginning of February, you were able to go.
You are correct. And that shows you where my head.
Oh, Lord. No one knows. It's okay.
It's been messed up.
I saw something today that said, today is this day. Tomorrow is that day. The next day is the other day. It's all fine. But yes, so you saw each other this year.
This year in Sedona, Arizona, and a rather ingeniously designed little theater that used to be a bank.
Yes. And that community loves that theater, and that's where all their art house films come. So it was really enjoyable to play there. Yeah.
Well, we love architecture in general, but of course, movie palaces are something. The first part of the fun is finding them, because you really don't ever know where they're going to be. You know, of course, as you say, like there's the big guys. There's, if you're in LA, Chicago, New York, you know, we tend to know about those, San Francisco, any of these major cities. But what's fascinating is to stumble upon them in other places. Mm-hmm. I was doing something last year where I was moderating Q&As before a film, and I traveled a little bit with it. And I got to go to two different movie palaces in
Flint, Michigan.
One in Flint, Michigan, and I forget what the other one was. It was gorgeous. And I walked in, and I must have been the first person in how many years who just couldn't stop taking pictures. They thought I was nuts. I just kept walking around, and I was calling my dad. I sent videos. I said, can you believe this place? It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
You do. You find these gems. They're absolute gems.
They absolutely are. They're all over the country. And in the documentary, we call them neighborhood movie palaces. And I think your dad is one of the people who describes it, you know, so well as being transported to another world. And even the ones that aren't, you know, the 6,000 seats like Radio City Music Hall or the Roxy was, even if they have 500 or 700 seats or whatever in a smaller community, they still have that same feel. And a lot of people today don't realize, maybe they go to these places to see a concert or to see traveling Broadway and have no idea that they were built to show movies. That's the part that really blows your mind when you think about that.
We got to go to the El Paso Film Festival some years ago.
Yeah.
And that's
the palace,
another one.
The palace theater.
That's this, they have an atmospheric, for anyone who doesn't know what an atmospheric theater is, it's, I think the best way to describe it is the theater is alive. That's sort of how I would.
You feel like you're outside when you're inside.
Yeah. The ceiling usually has its ability to shift, meaning that you'll see stars. In some cases, they
clouds.
Have whole routines where clouds will come across, the sun rises and sets. They're magnificent. And for me growing up, my dad has always, of course, I mean, anytime we see a good theater, we'll stop. But growing up, we would try to visit when we were going to be somewhere. If you knew that there was something, you know, an hour, even 2 hours away, we'd try to get to it. And this one in El Paso is another one where we walked in and you just go, oh my God. And they showed us the sun rising and setting, mm-hmm. clouds coming across the ceiling. Mm-hmm. It's just, they say.
Yeah, when I was touring around with the Movie Palaces documentary, I was at a film festival in Niagara Falls, and I was playing around the Buffalo, New York area, and everyone was like, you've got to see the Shays Buffalo, and it's a huge, beautiful theater, and they were having a performance of Mean Girls, so a touring Broadway, but I went there, and I told them at the door, I made this documentary about movie palaces. Everyone's telling me I should see it. And they were like, oh, you made that movie. Yeah, we saw it was playing at the film festival. Come on in. So even though the show was going on, somebody there that, you know, was a historian of the theater walked me around. We had to be quiet the whole time, but he showed me everything. Oh, look at this cool bathroom fixture and this and that. And here, let me sneak you into the auditorium. Oh, look at, so I did get a little private tour while a show was going on, which was pretty amazing. And that's been happening in a lot of cities when I was visiting. And I can't wait till these places are open again to, go back. And and hopefully that's what the film does, you know, now that it's coming out, when people, depending where you live, can't go to theaters, they will be able to see the film streaming now, and hopefully it helps build that education and appreciation for how important they are to Absolutely. Us culturally, to have that shared experience of seeing things in a theater where your attention is focused and you're with the crowd. It really is important for 100 years.
Yeah.
And hopefully people appreciate it even more once we have the opportunity to go to them again.
My dream has been for years to have us be able to host screenings at all of these different theaters. That was something I've talked to my dad for years about, it because,
like, your own roadshow.
That's it. Yeah. You know, the logistics of it, you know, money and all the rest of it is a whole thing. But to me, getting people to come out to those theaters, here in LA, we have the LA Conservancy that does a really good job getting people to our gorgeous theaters in downtown Los Angeles. And that helps maintain them as well. And they are, I mean, the fact that you've hosted, I don't even know how many screenings at this point, you know, with the different theaters in downtown LA. It's so thrilling to see them packed full. First of all, just to see them packed full, but then to see them packed full of movie addicts.
Yeah. You know? And yeah, I've been to a lot of those screenings. In fact, I think that's, I was at one in one of the theaters, I think at the Ace, at the United Artists, where your dad introduced a film during that Last Remaining Seats.
It might have been Double Indemnity.
And I think that is when I decided to ask him to be in the documentary, because I knew, of course, that he was a film critic and a film historian, but I didn't realize he had such a tremendous amount of love and knowledge for the theaters themselves, for the buildings. And once I saw him talking and I realized, oh, he's you know, a double wealth of information on both topics, he really should be in this film because it is something he's passionate about. So that's how we originally connected and got him involved with the film, because I saw how much he knew about the buildings themselves.
Well, I love them all, and I'm very happy to be in your film, and I'm really happy that we shot it at the 1926 United Artists Theater, now called the Ace Hotel. Mm-hmm. And the reason that a lot of these buildings have survived is because they have transformed them into performing arts venues. And that's what keeps them alive. Like the Fox Atlanta, which is just, you know,
knockout,
beyond description.
Yeah.
Is where Broadway shows go when they go on the road and go through Atlanta. And that's, you know, if we had our druthers, some of us, we would have them showing movies all the time.
Yeah. But whatever works.
But whatever keeps them alive.
We have a couple shots of the Fox Atlanta, and this is just a tiny trivia. The guy that does the beautiful score in Going Attractions, the Movie Palaces documentary, is named Chris Wermer, and he's trained. He went to Berklee Music School, but he'd been playing guitar for the Charlie Daniels Band.
Wow.
For decades. And I happened to be in Atlanta for a film festival, and he ended up being there to play with Charlie at the Fox in Atlanta. And so we got to run around an empty theater while they were, you know, preparing for the show that night and explore every single nook and cranny of the Fox. Mm-hmm. and take some images of it that ended up in the film. So that was super fun.
Oh, cool. Is it fair or unfair to ask if you have one or two favorites?
Well, I've asked you this, and I know yours. I'll see if you give the same answer that you've given before. But yeah, the United Artists is a favorite, even though I know it's had significant alterations. When you go in, you wouldn't know that at first, and it's just got layers of history, because there's remnants of when it was operated as a church for many years. And I love the original history of it. We cover this in the documentary, the idea of United Artists, why it was formed, the people who formed it, and especially I'm a big fan of, how could you not be, of Mary Pickford, and the fact that she was doing everything she did as a woman in Hollywood at that time, and that she had such a great influence on the design of that theater. Mm-hmm. So for all the layers of history, that's definitely one of my favorites. But I also really love the Uptown Theater in Chicago, mm-hmm. Which we also profile in the film, that is trying to raise the money to make a comeback. It's one of the largest ever built. And when I first rolled up upon it just from the outside and saw the marquee and the building, I was like, wow, I've got to get in there. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to talk Jerry, who owns it, into letting me in, because he's very, very protective of it. And he finally did, and we were able to shoot in there, and he's also in the film. So those are my two favorites. And of course, Radio City Music Hall.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And we have that wonderful story in the film too, how Rosemary Novellino Mearns and the Show People's Committee to Save Radio City Music Hall, how they narrowly saved that one from the wrecking ball.
Yes, I can't imagine Manhattan without Radio City Music Hall.
No.
I mean, you know,
it's as iconic as the Statue of Liberty. It's just another New York City icon.
It really is. And I grew up going there, not every week, but we lived in the suburbs in New Jersey. But my mom would take us into town, and we would inevitably be standing on a long, little moving line in the freezing cold for the Christmas show. And it just took forever because, you know, people were watching the movie and the show with the Rockettes and the Corps de Ballet and all of that. So it wasn't going to move. It was going to move after 2 hours or 2.5 hours. Yeah.
Well, and back then they would have the Christmas show and the movie would still be showing too.
Yes.
Today when you go, it's just a high ticket item to go to the Christmas show. Back then it was part of the regular show.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it just happened to have a Christmas theme that time of year.
Toward the end, I remember seeing ads in the newspaper that if you went before noon, it was only 99 cents to get in. This is just what a movie theater with still some components of live entertainment.
Yeah.
Just an incredible place, an incredible place. I want to talk a little bit about
that. I want you to say which is your favorite.
Yeah.
The Los Angeles.
That's the one you told me it was, yes. And it is a magnificent theater.
It's the largest one in LA, I believe. And the last one that was built. It opened in 1931 with Charlie Chaplin's City Lights. And they have a great photo in a showcase at the front of the theater of Chaplin and his special guest, Albert Einstein, at the premiere. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
One of the last times we were there for last remaining seats, I think they were showing, I think it was Robin Hood. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But I was sitting on the stage just off where you had just introduced it and the organ was playing and you looked out and it was full. It was full. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who go to the Conservancy events will dress up in the fashion. So you'll see 20s and 30s and 40s and, you know, people looking just absolutely fantastic. And to look out and see those people in the audience and then just sort of be sitting on that stage, I just sat down on the stage itself and watched. It was like, this is the coolest thing in the whole wide world. Mm-hmm. And for me growing up and going with you, you know, when you mm-hmm. took us to the theater in New York, so whether it was looking at those and going to the Christmas show, mm-hmm. you know, Radio City Music Hall and remembering it perfectly because it overwhelms you, or even here with the El Capitan, which is not, you know, quite the same, but considering the fact that so many kids go there, I love that kids will think of that when they think of a movie theater. So not just AMC, not just going to, you know, whatever it was that might be nearby, but you go into this place where everyone who works there, we've talked about the theater before because we love it. Everyone who works there cares. All mm-hmm. the people working there are really excited about sharing an experience.
Yes.
And, you know, you go
We should explain that it's Disney's flagship theater here in LA.
Right.
So you have the same kind of Disney a work ethic.
Cast members. They're not employees, they're cast mm-hmm. members.
Right.
The fact
that Disney brought that one back. It was a Paramount earlier and something else even before that. Mm-hmm. But you nailed it when you said experience. And I think that's the thing. When we're watching films at home, you know, maybe there's certain ones you're going to connect with, but it's also kind of a blur. Like, what did I watch yesterday, last week? When you go to a movie palace or you go to a drive-in, it's above and beyond the movie, that it's an experience and it's a memory. You create a memory. People can tell you, oh, I remember seeing this particular film in this movie palace, or I remember seeing this film at this drive-in. People will, you know, retain those memories because it gives you an experience, especially if it happens when you're a kid. It can make you fall in love with the movies.
It makes all the difference in the world. If a kid gets to go see, even if it's something, you know, whether it's a, you know, from Halloween into Christmas, they normally, again, this year is different, of course, but normally they're showing Nightmare Before Christmas there. And so, you know, parents get to take their kids to see the movie. So not only are they going to get to see it, but they're going to see it in that space. Mm-hmm. Or again, you have someone who will walk you to your seats and everything is lit and decorated. And you have the mighty Wurlitzer organ.
Yes.
And there too, the two people who play it, they are dedicated and they love it and they're showmen. You know, every piece of it. I just imagine.
The organ they have at the El Capitan is very special because it's the organ that came out of the San Francisco Fox, which was demolished in the 60s and lost a big preservation battle. So that is that organ that you can hear in the El Capitan, which makes it very special.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I want to go back to drive-ins for a little while. It occurs to me that from what I've seen in your movie and from other news stories, and again, as we all know, it's back in the news because it's one of the few places you can go and be safe and feel safe while still watching a movie. The people, the operators of drive-ins, it's not so much a job or a business as a calling.
Yeah.
and it spans generations.
Yes.
Fill us in for what you found out about that.
Well, all the drive-ins that are left, there used to be some bigger companies like here in the West, Pacific Theaters at one time had a lot of drive-ins, probably 40 of them just around Los Angeles alone. Now they only have one, which is the Vineland. But that corporate-owned is not existing within drive-ins, at least not right now. They're all family-owned businesses. Even if they have multiple locations, they are still family-based multiple locations. And a lot of people will say that drive-ins take on the personality of the owner a little bit because they can decide what it looks like and what color they paint things and how they treat their customers and what kind of food they serve. And you can get a bigger, fuller meal at a drive-in. So a lot of them have very specialty food items. And they are mom and pop businesses that are kept alive by families. There are some younger, newer people that have gotten into the drive-in business over the last couple decades, but a lot of times they're family businesses that have been, you know, continued generation to generation. And so you do get a very special experience going to the drive-ins, and they are keeping them alive out of passion and wanting to share it with future generations. So it is a special experience. And now this year with COVID, you're seeing a lot of pop-up drive-ins. You're seeing different companies get into the drive-in business. There's a drive-in outside the Rose Bowl here. There's one in the stadium in Miami. Yep. There's a lot of things happening. But what I think is kind of cool, when drive-ins first became a big deal, which was after World War II, after the baby boom, they were a place that the whole family could go in your car and have a night out, whether it's your kids or whatever. And they were hubs to the community, that people would see their neighbors there. And they did community-based programming and events. And that has come full circle now, that the drive-ins are the hub of the community again. They are the place you can go and have a barrier with your car for safety during a pandemic. And drive-ins are having church services. Yeah. Drive-ins are having graduation ceremonies. Drive-ins are having weddings. Some have been having dance recitals, you know, just anything that you can imagine, concerts, stand-up comedy, everything that you used to go to inside a different type of venue. Drive-ins are having all of these things all over the country. So that's really interesting.
Some communities have actually purchased the drive-in movies to keep them alive as a center.
As a venue.
A few. There's a couple nonprofits, Hull's in Lexington. It's called Hull's Drive-In, and they call it Hull's Angels, the group that's a nonprofit that runs it. But there's only a few. I would say the community ownership and nonprofit thing is more with some of the historic movie palaces where you've seen communities step in. For drive-ins, mostly they really are families. They're mom and pop businesses for the most part. Yeah.
Now I was reading up about your backstory, shall we say, and you made a short about the Passion Pit. The nickname for the makeout center of the universe for a generation of teenagers.
Yeah, and we played that at the Route 66 Film Festival, and I think I got a little award for it there. You know what that was when I was making the drive-in documentary, because it was my first documentary and it was self-funded, and while I was making it, I shot it in 2006, 2007, 2008, and then the economy took a major dive and it stalled the project. And so I kind of made that short out of some of my footage knowing that it was going to take me a long time to finish the feature, but maybe I can make a little something to whet people's appetite. So that's what that one was.
Very, very resourceful of you.
Yes.
And as a self-funded filmmaker, you have to be resourceful.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
What have you learned? Well, listen, you have a business degree and you've used your savvy. I don't know how much of your degree you used to become an entrepreneur. You're not just a filmmaker. You are also an entrepreneur. And I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Well, the parallel I always make, I do feel like filmmaking is creative, but it is also a business. So all of my business skills have been helpful. And I worked as a consultant and I worked for a lot of big companies prior to going into filmmaking. I worked for AT&T. I worked for Mattel Toy Company. I worked for Accenture that did consulting. Some of my projects were like Delta Airlines. And a lot of times I was a senior person where I was the only woman with a team of men. So that applies to Hollywood. A lot of times you might be one of few women as the director. So those personal skills of talking to people, presenting yourself, understanding where people are coming from, and even with actors too, to understand where they are, how they're seeing things, and be able to communicate to different types of people. All of that certainly is something that I got out of the business world. But also, I view films are very much like projects. So when I was doing consulting and project management, you know, you have a project to achieve a certain goal, and you're hiring people with the right skills, and you're doing a budget, and you need to bring things in on time and on budget. So that's exactly a film structure, that they're project based, and you're looking for the right talent to, you know, create your project, and you're dealing with budgets. And so those skill sets are very parallel to me. And then one of my focuses was marketing. And so when you're doing films, what we're doing right now, marketing is a big part of it, talking about your film and getting it out there and understanding your audience. So this is a very good convergence for me of all the things I've ever done leading up till now.
All right, what's next?
That's a great question. I'm working on a few narrative projects that are features and television with different partners. And hopefully one or more of those will end up getting traction. And I write, I write some things with partners sometimes. So, you know, I'm still early enough in my career that what's going to get traction, you don't quite know yet. Mm-hmm. But as far as documentaries, I am in a good position with a few that have been well received. And so I am working on a couple different documentary things that have come inbound to me that people had already kind of started, but looking for somebody to get involved with. And I actually have already shot a whole documentary following a traveling carnival.
Oh, wow.
Up in the Northwest that I shot over a few summers that I think I've shot everything I've needed to, but I haven't edited yet. So I have one in the can, but unedited that I need to find time to finish. So I've been very productive during the lockdown. And that's been a positive besides drive-ins getting attention is just having time to get to all these ideas and projects that have been on my back burner that, you know, the scripts that just needed one more pass or the thing I, you know, and so I've been extremely productive and we'll see, you know, you never know. Sometimes it's just timing for certain things to get the traction they need to move forward. And I'm pretty optimistic. Yeah. And despite the industry slowing down, I do think people are still looking for how they can make things or how they can be ready to make things when it's safe to do so. So I'm really optimistic that hopefully you'll be seeing a lot more from me if I can get a few of these things going.
We'll be thinking good thoughts.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, you know, passionate people attract other passionate people. And some folks are just the types who say, I'm going to get this done, so I'm going to get this done. And again, certainly being a documentarian, that on its own is, that's an uphill battle. You know, and beyond that, knowing that there are things that you have to fund yourself as you have, you know, you put everything into it. So it doesn't surprise me that you have a lot on the horizon.
Yep.
you know, it's exciting. And as I say, whether it's documentary or feature narrative, anything, it's when, I mean, people ask on an almost daily basis, do we think that everything's ending? Do we think that, you know, movie theaters are gone and all of this? No, never, never, not ever, not once. Because, I mean, if this has shown you anything, it's how much people love watching movies and love being entertained. And you know, like you, we try to always find the positive. This has also meant that a lot of smaller films have gotten a lot more attention than they otherwise might have done.
Right.
Because they're not opening at the same time as a huge blockbuster film. You know, so for the sake of our indies out there that have to work so hard, not to say that a big production film isn't also that, but we know what goes into something when you don't have a big budget and endless resources. I'm thrilled to see so many folks feeling like they're being more supported by the community, mm-hmm. And given an opportunity to watch something that otherwise just might have slipped through the cracks because there's so much else going on.
Yeah.
Yep, so, I agree. Right. I agree.
Let's wrap this up by giving a proper plug
yes.
to each film. Go one by one and tell everybody where and how they can see it.
Sure. So Stunt Women, The Untold Hollywood Story is distributed by Shout Factory, and they have it everywhere that you can get a new release right now. So it's on iTunes, Apple TV, Google Play, Vudu, anywhere that you can rent or buy a new release, you can find Stunt Women, The Untold Hollywood Story. And then the documentary that Leonard is wonderful in is called Going Attractions, The Definitive Story of the Movie Palace. And it will be out on October 20th. Same thing, all of the Apple, iTunes, Google Play, Vudu, all of that. But we also have that one on DVD. So if you like to collect DVDs, it will be on mostly every online retailer, Walmart, Best Buy, all those. And you can also buy it from my website, goingattractions.com, which will also show you where you can find it. And then Going Attractions, The Definitive Story of the American Drive-In Movie, which was my first documentary. It is all, you can also see the ways to see it from the website, but it's on Amazon Prime and a bunch of other places now where you can find that one. And I think hopefully you'll also see my filmmaking getting gradually better with each one too, because when I was making drive-ins, you know, I told you I shot it in 2005, 2006, a lot of it, some of it was shot high def, a lot of it was shot standard def, and we had to up-res it later. So You will definitely see my evolution in that regard too.
Well, but that's exciting.
Yeah. It is.
You know, that's exciting. It's been, I mean, it's crazy to think that I didn't even realize it was shot that long ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, I got stalled because of the economy. So it came out in 2013.
Sure.
So yeah, it's one of those stories where it took a while to make it because it was self-funded.
Filmmaking is easy. What are you talking about? It's simple. Just make a movie, right? Just make a movie.
Yeah. So,
in other words, there's no excuse not to see April Wright's films.
You can find them. They're everywhere.
She's omnipresent.
Omnipresent.
Well,
and now mention also your various social handles, because you're great about posting about all of this stuff.
Well, I have a Facebook page that is Going Attractions Facebook page. So it's everything about drive-ins and movie theaters that I post, not just stuff about, you know, places I go, but also anything that's happening in the industry, which is a lot right now for both drive-ins and theaters. And then on Twitter, I'm at driveindoc, driveindoc. And I have a Instagram too, which is just April_Wright_1999.
There you go.
Perfect.
And Jesse, where do people find us and how?
I am at Jesse Malton. You are at Leonard Malton on Instagram, Twitter, and you are on Facebook. You can also go to leonardmalton.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And we're on Patreon too.
Maltreon.
Where people can support what we do, and we very much value that support.
We appreciate it big time.
It's at patreon.com/maltononmovies. So that's where to find us and April and all the good stuff that you want to find. April, thank you again for being with us.
It was really enjoyable. So it's good to see you guys over, you know, I'd rather see you in person, but
I know.
Yes. Well, Zoom is where it's at right now.
Yeah, right. So we'll make a real life movie date soon because we are positive. And I am positive that at some point I will be sitting in a movie theater again.
Yeah.
Well, so long for now.
All right. Thanks, both of you. This is really fun.
Awesome. Thank you, April. Take care.
Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.